This is Audible.
HighBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents How to Be Safe, a novel by Tom McAllister, read by Amy Landon. Prologue. With some time to kill, the shooter parks his car outside One Brothers Pizza, and he thinks, it's just a slice. A slice won't slow me down. He thinks, a slice may even be good for me. He thinks, this is a choice. I'm making a choice, and nobody in the world has any say over whether or not I make this choice. Last night, he forgot to eat. Even after a full month of planning, there were loose ends to tie up. There were final considerations. He hadn't wanted to leave a note. But while he lay in bed, not sleeping, there were so many words in his mind desperate to escape, and he could feel them crawling like cockroaches out of his mouth. And so he decided to record them in his notebook. Later, they will find his notebook and call it a manifesto. The media will try to analyze it and explain it, but they are dull, and they cannot be trusted to understand. Next door to One Brothers is a small insurance agency with an oversized window, in which a pretty middle-aged woman sits as if on display. Her desk faces away from the street, but her body is turned so that he can see her profile, the cold curve of her cheekbone, the skin beneath her jaw sagging like an ill-fitting mask. He stands only 3 feet away from her, separated by the glass like a prisoner at visitation. Her blonde hair is cut in a bob and swept stylishly across her forehead, and she wears a blouse and skirt like something a mannequin at a high-end department store would wear. Her legs crossed, with her cell phone resting in the valley between her thighs, she stares down intently at her crotch, occasionally laughing and swiping fingers across the screen. She looks like a well-adjusted version of his mother. Like his mother, if she'd had better parents and gone to a good high school and been able to earn an associate's degree in something. If she would just look up from her phone, she would see him, and they could make eye contact and have something like a human connection. They could hold hands and have a picnic and dance in a field to a Billy Joel song and smoke cigarettes together under the moon. But she is playing a game, with bright colors and cute cartoon birds. And in those brief moments when she looks away from the screen, she seems to be thinking about something unpleasant, a fight with her ex-husband, or her son's college applications, or maybe trying to convince herself that the weird mole on her neck is nothing, and she's going to be fine. The phone on her desk rings, and she pivots to answer it, turning her back to him. She will see him on the news later, and not even know how close he'd been to her, how she could have saved everyone, if only she'd taken the time. Across the street, there's a gas station flanked by a 10-foot-tall brontosaurus statue, the dinosaur smiling grimly, as if he's just become aware of the extinction of his species, of the incurable loneliness that will plague him until he dies. It's a pretty dark joke by the proprietors, he thinks. A reminder that the fuel pumping into patrons' cars is the liquefied remains of millennia of once-living things, some long extinct. Every car is full of dead things, churning and grinding, and conveying people from one place to another. And eventually the people are dead, too, and replaced by other people. The monetization of large-scale death, the repurposing of extinction. He enters One Brothers, where the pizza is laid out like jewelry in a glass case. He points at a slice with pepperoni, and the man behind the counter slides the slice into the oven to heat it up, then turns his attention back to the TV in the corner of the room, which is tuned to a talk show that must be made for children and adults who have suffered traumatic brain injuries. The panel of hosts is debating the proper etiquette for farting in a restaurant, The audience laughs like a room full of dope fiends who have just gotten their fix. It is 11 o'clock. By noon, he will have killed 19 people, wounded 45. He is armed extensively, enough to take out more than that. But his gun will jam, and one of his homemade bombs will not detonate. The pizza scalds the roof of his mouth, and he feels the skin peeling off with the bubbling cheese, and he drops the slice back onto the plate, sauce slopping out of his burning mouth and searing his chin, and he thinks, fucking pizza, pizza, fucking fuck all the fucks. Then he thinks, I could just do it here. Then he thinks, if that guy looks at me again. Then he thinks, play it cool. You made a plan for a reason. Later, the pundits will speculate. They will look for reasons. They will want to know why. They will call him a loner, and they will quote former teachers saying he was bright but shy, and they never thought he'd be capable of something like this. They will say, nobody ever suspected it could happen here. The pepperoni is unctuous and too round, too obviously manufactured, too hot, too crispy, too indifferent. Pepperoni is made from dead animals, he reminds himself. They died for you. Like Christ. Except at least pepperoni serves a function. There are two jobs in the slaughterhouse. The slaughtered and the slaughterer. Most of them don't even know until it's too late. There will be a hero teacher who tackles him. And that hero teacher will be the last one to die. He bites into the pizza again, and now it's not too hot. It's so-called just right, and as he grinds it with his teeth and feels it sliding down his throat, it goes to that place in him that craves garbage, that is insatiable in its pursuit of grease and sugar and fat, that place in him he would cut out if he could, because then someone else could be the fat kid at school. The slob, the punchline. He feels the grease cooling inside him, congealing, and he feels at the same time satisfied and helpless and angry. And then he takes another bite. Everyone eats a last meal, even if most don't realize it at the time. You have a bowl of grain-based flakes and skim milk before heading to work and having a stroke at your desk. His father's last meal was a hot roast beef sandwich and a bag of chips, washed down with between 8 and 12 beers. He didn't come home from the bar. But that wasn't unusual. They didn't even think anything was wrong until the police called and said they'd found his car and someone ought to come in and identify the body. Rasputin's last meal was sturgeon in champagne sauce and poisoned honeyed cakes. Eichmann had half a bottle of red wine. Timothy McVeigh had 2 pints of mint chocolate chip ice cream. John Wayne Gacy ate deep-fried shrimp with fried chicken and strawberries. Gerald Lee Mitchell, a bag of Jolly Ranchers. Patrick Rogers, a single glass of Coke. Stacy Lawton, a jar of pickles. James Edward Smith, a clump of dirt. Dozens of condemned men ate pizza before they faced the firing squad or the chair or the injection. Everyone in the pizza shop is condemned, he thinks. They just don't have the luxury of knowing how or when the end is going to come. The door behind him swings open, bells ringing, a cop jangling fat and sloppy to the counter, too dumb to know what's going to happen, too dumb to even suspect. He is jovial, and everyone here knows him. He carries himself like the world is a good and fine place, and like there is meaning in being an overweight, small-town policeman who spends his days in a pizza parlor watching terrible TV. The officer will be one of dozens pursuing the shooter through the woods near the school, and he will be maimed by one of the traps laid there in advance. He will lose his left hand and sustain severe burns on the left side of his face, and he will never work active duty again. After 9 months of rehab, he will try to reclaim his life, but will never again feel like the world is a good or fine place. The shooter is finished, except for the crust. Eating the crust is unnatural. It's like eating the bones. And he wants to make a grand gesture when he leaves, give everyone in that room a story, so that years from now, they can tell people that the day the shooting happened, they saw him. So they can say, "I can't believe it could have been me." So they can say, "I could tell something wasn't right with that kid, but I didn't think he'd do that." So they can say, "If I could just go back and do it over again, I would have stopped him." But you can't do things over again. That's the point. He wants them to understand the randomness of fate, to understand that he himself is fate personified, and he chose not to kill them. Not because they're special or more important or better prepared or more faithful or more likable, but because there is no reason but unreason. He rises and goose steps toward the exit, his heavy boots pounding a warning into the floor. At the door, he pivots on his heels and salutes the room. He holds this pose for a moment, whistling taps, and then lowers his hand deliberately, like the soldier standing before him and his mother at his father's funeral. He turns sharply on his heels and leaves the pizza shop. He will not survive the shooting. He has no intention of surviving the shooting. There is no escape. Anywhere he goes will be the same. He will run only so that they chase him. His mother, drunk and alone at home, is watching TV and may not even know he has left the house. Next month, she will have a last meal of Canadian Club and onion rings and 100 aspirin. Her boyfriend Don will be investigated for murder when they find the bruises on her arms, but he will have an airtight alibi. He will try to wring the most out of the low-level celebrity he gains from his association with the whole ugly mess. But in the end, he will still be the same sad man he always was. In 17 years, Don will have a final meal of 3 saltines and some broth, spoon-fed to him by the hospice nurse. He pulls into the school parking lot. It is fourth period. Soon hundreds of his classmates will be herded into the cafeteria, and they will fill themselves with fried food, and they will be so loud. They think they have unlimited time, and they think the things they care about matter, but those things do not matter. The first shots will be fired in the cafeteria during lunchtime, and there will be explosives planted at the doors, so anyone trying to escape will be exploded. He will stalk the halls, firing randomly through barricaded doors, and catching the stragglers who are stuck without a hiding place. He will pull the fire alarm to make them think he set fire to the building, and he will pick them off as they flee. The hero teacher will be shot through the lungs, because this is not a world for heroes. This is a world for villains. This is a world for grand statements, not subtlety. After the shooting, they will investigate his journals and his music and his web browsing history, and they will try to paint a portrait that makes sense. They will shape a narrative around him that suggests the possibility of solutions. During the autopsy, they will find the pizza in his stomach, and they will find the residue of Adderall and Ritalin in his blood, and they will cut his brain open, hoping to find some clue about what makes people like him exist. But they will find nothing, besides what they always find. His brain is just another brain. It's connected to someone with a bad soul, but you can't bottle that or study it. The slivers of his brain placed on slides under a microscope will not show the memories, won't allow them to read the rejection and the emptiness and the abuse and the fear. The slides will not show the ways people can be ruined just by existing in the world. Shell-shocked acquaintances will say, without irony, that he had so much to live for, ignorant of the fact that the prospect of having to live like this for another 50 years was not the solution to, but rather the cause of, his hopelessness. He leaves his car running and doesn't bother closing the door. The walk to the school is short, only a few hundred feet, and he feels himself gliding across that distance. He feels suddenly deprived of his senses, blind and deaf and numb. There is no heaven, and there is no hell, and there is no afterlife. There is only now. There will be no white light for him to walk toward. He himself is the light toward which others will walk. He enters the school and then feels his material form disintegrating in the heat as he turns into a red giant star and then goes supernova and collapses on himself and becomes a neutron star, impossibly dense and powerful. And everyone nearby is drawn toward him by the immense gravitational force. And then he's a black hole. And then he is nothing at all. Just cosmic dust that used to be something. April. After, the sun turned gray and descended into the lake like a spider dropping from the ceiling. I saw it hit the water. I saw the steam rising up, and I felt the tremors when it crashed against the lake floor. I saw the displaced water splashing over the banks and rushing toward our houses. The experts say the sun is too big to fit into the lake, that it can't just fall. But they can't explain the darkness or the fog that hovered over us for weeks. They say it's basic science. A falling sun would extinguish the world, but I know what I saw. I trust the things I see. I spent much of my life trying to believe in things I'd read. I went through school. I'm educated. I know all the things I'm supposed to believe. But in what world do any of them seem right? Every fact they try to sell you can be disproven if you look in the right places. Everyone says truth is an objective thing. But what if I find a different truth that makes more sense? I heard the gunshots, but they didn't register as gunshots. I'd only heard a gun in real life twice before that day. The first time was when I was very young, when my father made me go on a hunting trip with him and his brother. It was an attempt to bond with an estranged sibling, to reconnect with some primitive vision of masculinity. He'd fired the gun in front of me, hoping to impress me. But all I remember is the look of monstrous glee on his face. The day of the shooting at the school, I thought at first that I'd just heard distant construction or a car accident. I was home when it happened. I hadn't been at work for 2 weeks because I'd been told I was not wanted at work. They had suspended me for a so-called outburst. Suspension of the right to work. That's what the official letter from the school district had said. Rights get suspended, and pants get suspended, and bridges get suspended. How does it all work? I don't know. I'm not an engineer. Everyone is suspended in some way, until they're not. The sun had been suspended in our sky for eons, and then it had seen enough. I watched the news. I ignored my phone, though it buzzed incessantly. My email inbox overflowed with people asking questions I could not answer. I deleted everything without reading it. My brother was trying to contact me, but I was afraid to answer. What could I say to him under these circumstances? I was very bad at lying to my brother, and I didn't want to frighten him. On TV, they called it a rampage. Then they called it a massacre. Then they called it a state of emergency. Then they settled back on massacre. I saw the faces. I saw Sarah R. with the blood on her blouse being led into the back of an ambulance. I saw Kelsey P. in the grass where sometimes I would teach my English classes on nice days. I saw a circle of students holding hands in prayer. I saw the windows shattered and the fire smoldering in the gym. These were people I knew, lying dead in places I knew. Changing the channel did not make it disappear. Sometimes life is so graphic, it's impossible to process. On TV, they speculated. Could it be terrorism? Maybe it was a student. Maybe it was a drill gone horribly wrong. A disgruntled former employee. A random act of violence. An escaped convict. An angel of death. A different kind of terrorist. To be on the news, you just need to own a suit and be willing to guess about anything. You become someone who opines for a living. Opinions need to happen fast or they don't count. They were grasping for suspects, and they showed pictures of recently fired employees. They showed my face. They said my name. "This is Anna Crawford," they said. She was recently fired from her job as an English teacher for insubordination. She posted a message online saying she hates the place. She said, and I quote, "I should have burned the place down when I had the chance." She added, hashtag bitter, hashtag spite, hashtag fuck that place. On the screen, the text said, "Former teacher had motive." Until that report aired, I was unaware that I had been fired. I thought I was suspended. The knocking started minutes later. It was the media first. They filmed me through the windows, and I remember thinking, beyond anything else, I am not wearing a bra. They are going to see that I'm not wearing a bra, and it is going to be on TV. The news was running on a 5-second delay, so as I watched the media assembling outside my house, I was also watching my recent past self on the screen. She looked so much younger than me. I felt a pang of nostalgia for the life I'd been living just minutes ago. I felt the international media rustling through my pockets and ransacking my life, dumping out drawers, hoping to find evidence that I had committed a mass murder a mile away from my home. I felt their hands all over me, violating me. I opened my door and shouted, "You do not have permission! I don't grant it to you!" I shouldn't have opened the door. When the barbarians are at the gates, you do not lower the drawbridge, even if you have something really important to say. One of them entered my house, and there was a scuffle. The next thing I knew, I was in the back of a police car still being filmed. Later, I would watch the video and see that I was laughing as they drove me away. I can't explain that. I don't remember it at all. While I was gone, the FBI destroyed my home. They broke holes in my drywall looking for caches of weapons. They tore up the carpets and poured my trash cans onto the floor. They found nothing incriminating. Later, they would leave a note saying, "The FBI was compelled by your behaviors to search your home. The FBI is not responsible for any damage incurred by your home during this search. By reading this document, you agree to the terms above." They say the FBI doesn't have a sense of humor, but they're wrong. The FBI loves to laugh. Nobody told me what was happening. On TV, they reported that I was a person of interest, not under arrest. They were just interested in me, which allowed them to deny my rights. After 5 hours, they gave me some water. They told me that when they came back, I'd better be ready to tell them everything. They didn't come back for another 5 hours. During the few days they held me prisoner, my entire life had been shared with the world. I had become public property. Everyone knew by then who the shooter was, but there was a frantic hunt for possible co-conspirators. On the internet, they pored over all the scraps of my life they could find. Hundreds of websites posted articles investigating inconsistencies in my alibi. My biography had become so-called content, a disposable distraction to keep people occupied for a week. someone with thousands of followers, posted my home address. High school classmates suddenly had stories about me they needed to tell. They remembered me being weird. "She always kind of creeped me out," a person named Corey said. I don't remember ever meeting anyone named Corey. I wasn't even sure Corey could be a person's name. Reports cited anonymous sources talking about everything I'd ever done wrong. Shoplifting, taking too many smoke breaks at work, knocking over a neighbor's mailbox after an argument. An ex shared nude photos of me because, he said, anyone who could kill kids had lost her right to privacy. Later, a reporter asked me if I was embarrassed by the pictures, if I wanted to apologize for taking them. They found my brother, Calvin, while I was in jail. Not that he was hiding from them. He'd moved away years ago, so he could be free of this town and all the people in it. I didn't see the video until later. He stood in his doorway, holding his toddler daughter, who buried her head in his chest to hide from the camera's lights. I hadn't seen his face in a very long time. He still sent me videos and pictures, but he was always behind the camera, recording his children and his wife. His hair was receding prematurely, and he looked like he'd lost weight, like he'd been working out. He listened politely to the reporter's question, and he said, "What exactly do you want from me?" He stepped closer to the camera. "What do you want me to say to you?" The reporter stood his ground and said, "We'd like you to share your thoughts on your sister's alleged involvement in the Seldom Falls massacre." Calvin glared at him, and I saw his eyes flash with the old menace. I saw him trying to decide whether it was worth it to assault the reporter. "Motherfucker, I don't share my thoughts," he said, and went back in his house. In the days after the shooting, the news anchors all thought they were being very clever by pointing out that it had occurred in what was once America's friendliest city. A major magazine had given this honor to Seldom Falls, Pennsylvania, 3 times in the 80s, when I was still young enough to believe in such things. Many of the shops on Main Street have faded signs in their windows saying, "Welcome to America's friendliest city." It's not even technically a city anymore, not since the population was cut in half. It's a township. The friendliness is a commodity in a town with nothing else to sell. When people come here, it's because they're on the way to somewhere else, or because they want to be left alone. They rent a cabin near the lake and spend a week hiding from whatever they left behind. It was easy to fill in the blanks on the template. Idyllic small town, never thought it would happen here. Shocked residents, B-roll of trees and nature. Our proximity to nature was supposed to inoculate us against the evils of the big city. But nature is crueler than anything man can invent. Nature kills for no reason every day. If you want to make people safe, the best thing to do is to ban nature, to arrest nature and put it in jail where it can't bother us anymore. In the late 18th century, a pair of brothers named Seth and Ephraim Seldom settled here among the natives and declared themselves the owners of this land. They'd been born to an aristocratic family in Rhode Island, but had to flee due to a conflict with the local church. There are no falls here, but the gusting of the wind over the lake can rustle the trees loudly enough that it sounds like a distant waterfall. A number of streets are now named after the natives who lived here, a lukewarm penance for colonizing their land. We didn't learn much about what happened to the natives, but I know their blood saturates the soil. I can taste the blood in the crops the farmers grow here. When I was 12, I spent a week during my summer vacation digging a hole in the backyard so I could hide in it during the day. Each time I cut into the earth, I knew I was slicing through the degraded bodies of natives, knew each rock would be the fossilized bones of massacred people. The school was a safe school. It was in a safe town. It was attended by safe people. Everyone kept repeating these lies. "We are not like those other schools," they said. At my first teaching job after college, in the kind of unsafe place where they send inexperienced teachers, we had daily briefings running down the previous day's fights. We were required to take self-defense classes. That school was the first one in the city to install metal detectors and put bars over the windows. When I told people where I worked, they gasped as if I just told them I had cancer. Many of the families in Seldom Falls had fled here from nearby cities. My mother's father was mugged by a black man in Pittsburgh, and 3 weeks later, he moved here to start over. My father's father didn't like how many black families were moving into his neighborhood in Cleveland, so he left before his children could be degraded by the new neighbors. We were raised to understand that being here was what kept us safe. When I was young and our neighbors sold their house, they knocked on the door to assure my father that they wouldn't sell to the wrong kind of people. The first time I ate a meal with a black person was in college, when I had lunch with classmates to discuss a group project. It was the first time in my entire life that I'd thought about what it meant to be white. 4 years later, I was teaching at an urban school with only a handful of white students. We spent every day bracing for a violent eruption. But it was never as bad as they said it would be. Teenagers got in fights because they were teenagers. The boys lost their tempers and feuded over girls and hurt each other for sport. The girls stole from one another and got into screaming matches, and every now and then one of them burst open with an intensity that could only be fueled by trauma. But the violence was all localized and contained. After a few years, I moved back here like everyone else, thinking I could get away from the threat of violence. But violence goes wherever it wants. It's like water, flowing through every crevice and breaking down your walls and dragging you screaming out to the sea. May. The police didn't drive me home when they were done with me. They just told me to go. This town is too small to have cabs and the buses are unreliable, so I walked a half mile to Renee's house. Renee and I went to college together for a year before she transferred out of state. I stopped taking classes 6 months later and moved to an apartment 2 blocks from where I grew up. I had no interest in going back to my parents' house, but some ineffable force kept me in its orbit. I was too immature then for college. I got a job as a waitress and spent nights trying to wash the smell of fried food out of my hair. I left my lights on all day and never closed my windows because I knew this would annoy my mother when she drove by and saw that I was being wasteful. My father knocked on my door once and asked if he could watch my TV because my mother had broken his. Otherwise, they never visited me. Every time Renee came home, she told me how great the parties were at her school, how lame Seldom Falls was, how, no matter what it took, I had to get away from this place. She moved back 5 years later with the man she would soon marry and eventually divorce. She'd had a miscarriage and then couldn't get pregnant again, and he wanted children more than he wanted her. Now she owns a 3-bedroom house that's too big. I knocked on her door, and she pulled me inside and held me. She absorbed my tears until my head felt completely empty. I lay on her couch while she made me tea. She forced me to eat something, even though I'd lost my appetite so long ago I didn't remember ever liking food. I told her I heard the police helicopters in my dreams. I told her about the gunshots. She told me the media had been relentless in pressuring her for gossip, but she hadn't cracked. Later, I would learn this wasn't true. Anybody who has information about you will give it up eventually, for the right price. For Renee, it was $500 and a new transmission for her Toyota. That was all it took for her to give them pictures from my college years. Me with the man I almost married. Me flashing my middle finger at the camera. Me doing shots in a bar. She was the anonymous source close to the suspect, who said, Anna means well, but she can be unstable. She's like an old cat. You know how sometimes they love you, and other times they want to claw your eyes out? I had been publicly cleared of all wrongdoing, but that didn't matter. Conspiracy theorists thought I had probably done it and was being protected by the government for some reason. I received occasional emails from amateur detectives who accused me of helping the government run a false flag operation. Others admitted I hadn't done the shooting. They acted like this was a gracious concession, admitting that all the facts existed as facts. But they were still convinced I was guilty of something. They needed me to be bad. Everything that happens is covering up some other thing that's even worse. Facts are not facts at all. They're just the first line of an argument. By the time I returned to my house, the media had moved on from me. My lawn had been trampled and someone had pawed through my garbage. The inside had been ransacked by the FBI. I stepped over the wreckage and sorted through the pile of mail that had accumulated under the slot. There were two letters from Calvin. He'd gotten in the habit of writing letters when he was in rehab and wasn't allowed access to his phone or the internet. The only people left in the country who write letters are prisoners. He had called a dozen times and sent me messages every day. I knew I had to call him back. I knew it wasn't fair to be silent. I had been hoping if I just pretended none of this was happening, I could save him from it. I decided that if he called me again, I would answer. It was his responsibility to try one more time, I thought. He called an hour after I walked through the front door.
"It's a good thing you answered," he said. "If you didn't, I was going to drive over there and wait for you."
If I'd had to see him at that moment, I would have shattered. Sometimes you can love someone enough that you never want to see them. The love is too intense for you to be in the same room. Love is not magnetic. It is repulsive. It creates an energy of sickness and anxiety that can destroy everything. The earth loves the sun, but it maintains a safe distance so it doesn't get incinerated. "Just so you know," I said, "I didn't do the shooting."
"I know," he said.
"But you believed them when they said it."
"Honestly, if I knew it was an option when I was 17, I probably would have done it myself," he said.
The last time I had seen Calvin in Seldom Falls was at my mother's funeral. He hugged me and told me he loved me, and I told him again how sorry I was for not being better. He kneeled at the casket and prayed, and I did not know what he could be praying about or to whom. I resented him for having the recourse of prayer when I couldn't find a way to make it work for me. It felt like a betrayal for him to find solace in a God I couldn't identify. Did he love my mother? Did he love a God or Jesus or someone else? I was never supposed to know I had a brother. My father thought he'd be able to keep it a secret, but he was not that clever a man. My parents were going through what my mother called a rough patch. It was rough in the sense that they were realizing they'd made a terrible mistake by getting married. My father had married a 22-year-old and resented her for aging. I could never picture him as a young man. He was always tired and old and hard. I could visualize my mother as a young woman, and every now and then I imagined her as the sort of person I could have been friends with. Not good friends, but good enough. I was 7 when my younger brother was born. My father had gotten a 17-year-old pregnant. She was a friend's daughter. They'd had an affair for several months. She wanted an abortion, but he wouldn't allow it, due to some latent religious convictions I'd never known he had. A year later, I learned about all of it while I ate breakfast before school. My father dunked a plain bagel in his tea and scanned the comics page. He dunked and dunked and then ate the soggy bagel. My mother glared at him across the table while I slurped on cereal. He didn't have a job then. He was planning on going out and applying soon. Before I got up, my mother said, "So, when does Anna get to meet her little brother?" I think my mother had waited that full year for him to finally come clean, getting angrier every day he acted as if nothing had happened. He dunked his bagel again, and then folded the paper calmly.
"What an interesting question," he said, turning to me. "Isn't your mother just a fascinating woman?"
I had three fathers. There was the father I had as a child, the one I had after Calvin's existence was revealed, and the one I had after Calvin moved in with us 5 years later. You don't have to explain the Trinity to me, because I get it. There is the loving father, the desperate father, and the defeated father. And they are all one. It took me many years to understand all of this. The loving father left after his son was born. I didn't think this was my fault, but people kept telling me it was not my fault, and that made me certain it actually was my fault. The desperate father wanted to be something he could not be, something he had once been, but had lost. The loving father had naturally bonded with me from the start and had been my best friend. Then, in that 5-year gap between Calvin's birth and his move into our house, the desperate father tried too hard to prove he was still the man he used to be. He took me to sporting events and carnivals and concerts for nostalgia acts. He pulled me out of school during the day and took me to the movies. He hid gifts in my room, sneaking candy to me when my mother was asleep. He smiled too hard at me, and he sweated constantly. He wanted something I could not give him, which was forgiveness for being a bad husband. The defeated father either loved Calvin too much or not at all and could not bear to look at him. He was living a life he didn't want anymore, and every time he looked at us, he was reminded of all the other lives he could have had. His silences were violent, and I felt them from blocks away. Alone all night, he sat in the living room with the TV on mute and music playing in his ears. It was clear the shooter had acted alone, and that there were no co-conspirators. So now there was a rush to assign blame. Carl S., the guidance counselor, had to explain how he'd missed the red flags. The police had to explain how they'd missed the red flags. The shooter's few friends had to explain how they'd missed the red flags. There were red flags, the papers said. It's just that nobody saw them. When everything you see is a red flag, it's impossible to know which ones matter. If you are in danger everywhere you go, then you start to ignore all the warning signs. The police were not equipped to handle a crime of this magnitude. Journalists found consistent breakdowns in the system. There had been a couple reports from the parents of a classmate who said the boy was acting strangely and lashing out over petty slights. He had posted bizarre things online about hatred and vengeance and guns. But we lived in a town where people hunted, so everybody always bragged about their guns. Guns were gifts you got for 13-year-old boys. On Independence Day, the annual parade ended with shooting competitions divided into senior, adult, and youth divisions. Before I was born, a teenager from Seldom Falls had placed 5th in the Olympics in the 300-meter rifle event. But it was more than the guns. The shooter had written the word Muerte in marker on the locker of the class president. A girl at school had accused him of snipping off chunks of her hair during class and keeping them in a Ziploc bag in his locker. But the principal had told them to settle it between themselves. The day of the shooting, the police rolled out their full arsenal, but they had never practiced anything like an active shooter drill. On TV, they said a faster response could have saved up to 10 lives. Every parent or spouse of every victim had done the math and was convinced their son or daughter or husband or wife would have been among the up to 10 spared. The chief of police had vowed not to resign in the face of public pressure. The mayor promised to double the security budget. He vowed to spare no expense. He said, "We are going to pursue safety obsessively and intensely. We will not be defeated." The mayor's name was Randy C. He was my age, but his hands were tiny and delicate, and his face still looked like it did when we were in school together. If not for his receding hairline, he would have looked like a teen in a discount suit. He used to cheat off me in algebra, and once, when we were both at a classmate's 14th birthday party, he and I ended up in a closet together for 7 minutes. The popular kids drew our names from a hat, then locked us in a closet and told us we were going to heaven. He'd never kissed anybody before, and his tongue swirled around in my mouth like a dog trying to lick the last remnants of peanut butter out of the jar. He kept pressing his hands against the hook on my bra, but didn't have the courage to unclasp it. For the next 2 years, he avoided eye contact with me. When we graduated from high school, he shook my hand and wished me a good life. "You be good, kid," he'd said. After you're killed, the media needs to determine whether you deserved to die. They need to know whether to feel sad for you. There is a finite amount of sadness in the world, and the only way to process a mass killing is if it turns out some of the victims were less deserving of life than others. They suggested that Abdul F., the graduate student who was shadowing teachers in the math department, had self-radicalized and that he could have become a threat to national security. They found that Joe M. owed months of back child support. Ronnie B. was a beloved physics teacher, but she also had written some strange anti-government posts on social media, and there had been rumors of a relationship with the principal, Hank T., who had a reputation for cheating on his wife. One by one, they were tried and judged as slightly less worthy than the others. It was important for people to feel like the murders could somehow be justified. They couldn't figure out how to feel better about the 12 dead children. When my parents were young, they had newspapers and radio and TV, but there were limits on when and how they could access them. It was possible to develop a cohesive worldview and also to detach yourself from all of it when necessary. Now, at all hours, I could watch the conservative news network or the liberal news network or the centrist news network. They all told me we were doomed, but for different reasons. The news networks were run by billionaires, and the on-air talent were wealthy New Yorkers who ate at the same restaurants and pledged allegiance to their ratings. They looked the same, and they represented no meaningful ideology. They aided and abetted the shooters by confusing the narrative. They didn't know anything about the world, but we trusted them because they dressed nicely and spoke with such certainty. I didn't know what I wanted from the news, but I kept returning and hoping for something better to happen, or at least to be able to witness the next awful thing. Every story was followed by a counter-story, calling the original a lie, and then the journalists spent the day bickering about which stories were fake and which were not. It was impossible to believe anything, besides that we were in danger. You can consume so much media that it becomes toxic. The only option is to flush the system, to purge yourself and feel it burning in your esophagus, then see it pooled at your feet. The media found heroes, too. There was John Kay, the biology teacher who'd done a stint in the National Guard and led a weekly Bible discussion group after classes. He hustled the students into the gym and barricaded the door before chasing the shooter and trying to subdue him. The media kept coming back to his story as proof that good exists in the world. There was a redemptive arc. They showed photos of him with his own children, and him in his uniform, and him in church. A syndicated columnist wrote that the cultural construct of masculinity was to blame. She wrote that there is a mass pathology afflicting men in this country, and the real solution is not to persecute an overworked guidance counselor, but instead to reshape societal values in such a way that boys aren't praised for violence and celebrated for suppressing their emotions. She said we're training them to be little killers with rage problems. The columnist received death threats online. In the comments, they called her a bitch and said maybe she just needed to get fucked. They told her they wanted to kill her and fuck her in that order. Men think their dicks are the solution to every problem they face. When I was 14, my uncle asked me a question about school, and I said something sarcastic back to him, and everyone laughed. So later, he grabbed my arm and pulled me aside and said, "Your tits aren't big enough to act like such a bitch." He squeezed my bicep and stared hard enough to let me know how easily he could break me. "What you need is to go and get fucked, and maybe you'll finally loosen up." I spent most of my time at future family events, trying not to be alone in a room with him. I never told my parents. I was afraid they would blame me for it. I was even more afraid they would make me talk to my uncle about it. He never said anything like that again, but he didn't need to. My problem is not a lack of dicks. My problem is an abundance of dicks, being surrounded by dicks, always being reminded that they're ready to be unsheathed and used as a corrective if I step out of line. On TV, they told us it was not the right time to politicize the tragedy. You can't talk about it in the aftermath, because nobody will listen. You can't talk about it later, because then it's old news. It's in bad taste to use the victims to score political points. There is no right time to talk about the causes, because the event has already occurred, and if you spend time talking about the causes, then you're disrespecting the effects. The news replayed the security footage endlessly. For a month, turning on the TV meant you might see grainy images of the shooter hustling up the stairs to the third floor. And then you could see the muzzle flash and the recoil. You could see him stepping over bodies. Then you could watch more commercials. Murder had been commoditized and repackaged as entertainment that could be digested in 5-minute chunks. Dead children sell fast food and probiotic yogurt and web hosting. Dead children move product. Gun sales had risen 300% since the shooting. Everyone had guns, even people who didn't have guns. There were people who said guns were dangerous, that the national obsession with guns is the reason people keep getting killed, that 2 centuries of gun worship had poisoned our culture, that if we just, once and for all, made a decision to eliminate as many guns as possible, then we would all be safer. But guns can't be banned, because if guns were banned, then how would we stop people who have guns? If nobody had guns, then how would people use guns? If guns didn't exist, then what would people put in their holsters? If people didn't have guns to put in their holsters, then what would they use to shoot at birds? If people couldn't shoot at birds, not to mention deer and bears and snakes and evil spirits, then wouldn't the world be overrun with birds? With deer and bears and snakes? With evil spirits? If guns were banned, then how would men kill their wives? How would men kill themselves? How would men exact revenge on the world for not giving them everything they'd ever wanted? I wrote to my congressman with a solution. Instead of manufacturing bulletproof vests and bulletproof glass, because you can't always be in a vest or behind glass, we should begin manufacturing bulletproof children. It would be expensive, but who can put a price on the life of a child? What parent can say, "No, I don't want you to be impervious to bullets. I want you to risk your life every day." Instead of banning guns, what they needed to ban was people who get shot. If we stopped having shootable people, then guns wouldn't be such a problem. Guns could be used for their true purpose of killing non-humans and empty beer cans. A month after the shooting, I went back to the gym. I was trying to act normally. Everyone kept saying we needed to get back to normal, to not allow the shooter to change our lives. If we let terror win, then terror wins. This is a country of winners, and one important thing winners don't do is lose. I used to go at least 3 times a week, cardio and Pilates and dynamic weightlifting movements. My body was not what I wanted it to be. Every body is a disappointment to its owner, but mine was also a capable and healthy, and viewed in the right light, an attractive body. I looked like a person who could pick things up and move them without help. I looked like a person who could go on a nature hike. But there is no point in having a good body, because bodies are too fragile. No matter what anybody does to ward off death, they will die before they're ready. 30 minutes of cardio means nothing to the shooter. Bullets can penetrate even the hardest muscles. Working out is a way for us to trick ourselves into thinking we have a chance. I was on the treadmill in the morning, and I was running at my normal pace on an incline, and I was looking away from the TVs where the Republican pundits were blaming the Democrats for the shooting and vice versa, and nobody was listening to anybody. I was running, and then I heard the door open behind me. Without turning, I saw the shooter pushing through the front door, strapped with bullets and grenades. There were 4 emergency exits. I had begun taking note of the locations of emergency exits. But they would be wired with explosives, and there was no place I could run. There was no way to be safe, and there was no way to be healthy, because health and safety are myths. I had stopped running, and the treadmill belt spit me onto the floor like a tongue rejecting food. Everyone stared at me, and I knew what they were thinking. The last thing we need is another crazy person around here. Everywhere in Seldom Falls, people were busy erecting barriers and other safety measures to prevent the occurrence of the thing that had already happened. Even the restaurants were installing metal detectors. Buying a sandwich now meant stripping off your watch and your belt and your jewelry and your shoes, and allowing your bag to be x-rayed, and maybe being patted down by a guard before sliding your cash through a slot in bulletproof glass. Everything took so much longer. It was easier just to stay home. The only places that didn't change were the gun shops. There you could still stroll in and plunk down your cash and walk out with a handgun within minutes. One of the problems with living in the friendliest town in America is that people are always being friendly with you. Friendliness is a virtue, and friendliness is a weapon. By the time I was in high school, I'd begun to feel stifled by the friendliness. I was 15, and I went to the pharmacy to drop off a prescription for birth control. The cashier had gone to high school with my father, and she called him to ask if he knew what I was up to. He did not know what I was up to, because by this point he'd become detached from himself and would go days without speaking to anyone. He asked my mother, and she said she had no idea either, even though it was her suggestion that I acquire birth control pills. My mother was vain, and not the sort of person you could rely on. It was very important to her that people perceive her as having what she called a classy family. The cashier told me to stay there and wait for my father to come pick me up. "You really shouldn't go sneaking around like this," she said, "after everything your father's been through." She reached across the counter for my hand, which I gave her because I'd been raised to be polite. "I noticed your family hasn't been in church in a while." I barely knew her. The pharmacist looked at my script and shook his head. He had been my softball coach when I was younger. "I can't fill this without one of your parents here," he said, which was not true. I knew that even then. Part of being young is being lied to by adults constantly and being forced to accept it. You can't fight every lie, because then they say you're difficult, and if you're difficult, then they spend all their time trying to fix you.